I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everyone. Today, my guest is Eric Vance. He is a science writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Scientific America, and National Geographic. He is also the author of Suggestible You, The Curious Science of Your Brain's Ability to Deceive, Transform, and Heal, which also comes out by National Geographic. Thank you so much, Eric, for being on my show today.
Thanks for having me.
I was so interested in this topic, as I've been for a while, about how the brain can create healing in the body and how influential it is, maybe a lot more than what we can tend to think it is. But the idea about placebo itself and studying that, placebo studied against drugs usually to see if drugs are effective. But I've always thought, but what's actually happening when people are healed by nothing?
Exactly.
That's really fascinating. And I think your background as a Christian scientist and as a child influenced you a lot. I've heard that when I first got to listen to you was on the Tim Ferriss show. And maybe you can go into some of your background a little bit.
Sure. Well, your feeling about that sort of these curiosity about the placebo effect, it's shared by a lot of scientists. Mm. And, going back to the 1950s, pharmaceutical companies have used placebos as a measure in which to tell if a drug works or not. Mm. But no one really asked these questions about what exactly was happening. It was sort of ignored and sort of left aside because it seemed almost unanswerable. And all the attempts to answer it, kind of came up against a wall. Since the 1970s, we've sort of been chipping away at it and we're getting to the point now where we really got a good picture of what's going on, at least with some placebos, which is a long way to sort of bring us around and say, I knew nothing of this growing up. Mm. in the 1980s. I grew up in a family of Christian Zionists. Mm-hmm. Who use faith healing as a way to as a healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so when you get sick, you pick up a copy of the Bible and you treat yourself with your own mind. And I actually left that religion sometime in the 90s, but I sort of kept this curiosity. Mm-hmm. And it was very much sort of in the same vein is this curiosity about placebos. There's sort of this sort of these lingering questions that I had, and I think that on the one hand, and that scientists had on the other hand about what is this thing that happens to people who, and probably maybe some people, maybe not other people. It's very, very curious, but what is happening? And that's sort of where this all kicked off was. My curiosity was kind of in line with many people who'd come before me.
Mm. Well, yeah, I've heard a lot about faith healers and, are they tricking people? Are people healing themselves? Is there a science? Are these people just gullible? And so you hear a lot about all kinds of different things, I'm sure there's a whole gamut of things that could be going on. Some people are running a scam, and then some people are probably something's happening in their body that's helping them to be cured of something. But mm-hmm. one of the things that I picked out from the material about your book is that we're not talking about gullible people who are cured by placebo. This isn't like a stupid person would fall for something like that, right? We're not talking about mm-hmm. that.
Yeah, it's funny. That was one thing that kept coming up again and again when I started looking into this. So I started kind of in this quest, with some of these. I mean, this goes. My research ended up very quickly going all the way back to Hippocrates in the days of the ancient Greeks, because placebos have been with us for a long time. A belief, you know, affecting our body has been with us a long time. And Hippocrates was sort of trying to figure these things out, you know, and trying to figure out if it was the gods or if it was our bodies. And then later, Avicenna, the Persian genius, was trying to figure out, you know, how do you separate a drug from a human reaction? You know, these things have been with us. Mm-hmm. And the theme that comes up again and again, at least in recent history, is the sense that people who have placebo responses or the placebo response, it's some sort of impurity, you know, it's some sort of mistake. It's like you said, gullible. And there's this great study. Oh goodness, I think it was out of Yale or Harvard in the 1940s, and the scientist ends up getting, gosh, what did he get? I think he got a 60% placebo rate or something like that. You know, like people feeling better, 60 or 70. It was a headache. He was studying headache medicines, and he called the people who didn't get better on placebo like the pure group, like they were a pure group. Well. He's kind of ignoring the vast majority of us, and that's what I sort of learned, is that this is who we are. This happens to all of us, and whether we like it or not, this is part of being human, and we aren't as reliable as we think we are, but there's a lot of benefit in that, and it's something that we can't ignore. So that was something that was very interesting.
Yeah, and it's kind of a half full or half empty. You could say we're not as reliable, or you could say there's something pretty amazing about being able to heal yourself without drugs.
You know? Yeah, it is. It is. And I have a section at the end of a chapter later. A lot of my book focuses on placebos, but not all of it. I also have a section on hypnosis. And the same thing is true in hypnosis. You know, think about how you see someone who's easily hypnotized. You know, do you see them as being strong or powerful, or do you see them as being sort of weak? And people who study hypnosis call hypnotizable people, they call them talented, because they do have a talent. They have this ability to drop into this level of trance that allows them access to certain parts of their subconscious. And that's a weird shift. And I think a lot of your listeners can sort of think about that for a second. It does feel a little weird to think of it that way.
Wow. Well, when you were growing up, did you actually see miraculous healings and things like that? Or was your exposure not fairly limited? Was it like, what did you experience growing up as far as like what you would consider? Because you weren't exposed to things like typically to doctors and hospitals and things like that.
Yeah, my definition of miracle is constantly changing.
Right.
But I definitely saw things that seemed miraculous. But more importantly, I also heard about them. You know, this is a very powerful thing when you're talking about expectation. That's what we're talking about with all of these things. We're talking about meddling with human expectation. What your belief is, but a very deep form of belief. Sometimes when it comes to expectation, the stories are just as powerful as the reality. So a lot of this story, I mean, I can tell you, you know, about colds and pains and aches and a lot of different things we got, you know, healed or friends healed, and they're very impressive. But the ones that really stuck with me as a kid were these sort of really miraculous stories that I didn't have personal contact with. Cancer or AIDS disappearing from people. But that informed my expectation for my own chicken pox or my own little problems, you know, and that's where a lot of this comes into play in terms of the science. I'm not out to try and figure out if miracles are real, but I am interested in how minor miracles happen and how the larger ones sort of inform us, prime us to be able to tap into these expectations. You know, when you hear about someone doing these things, or you watch a TV commercial and they're advertising something that seems miraculous, that's priming you to have your own expectation, you know, when you take that therapy.
Well, speaking of priming, and, you know, this is you were mentioning that if doctors don't employ some of these ideas that that are benefits of placebo effect, that they're kind of throwing away 30% cure possibilities, mm-hmm. potentially. And that whole idea of priming the brain and expectation, what do you know what's happening inside the brain, that what's going on in there that's doing this kind of expectancy stuff?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'll take a step back and sort of give you the wider picture, because I think that's helpful. Mm. Smarter people than me have called the brain a giant prediction machine.
Yeah.
That's essentially what the brain does, mm. is it makes predictions, little ones, big ones. It basically tries to use the past in order to predict the future. And that's, to some extent, what your brain does. And so expectancy or expectation is, what psychologists call it that, in the brain is basically your brain making a bet, mm-hmm. on what's going to happen. And sometimes, you know, you think about, is the ground in front of you hard? You know, your brain makes, you know, every day, you know, it makes a pretty solid bet that when you put your foot down, you know, it's going to stick. It's you know, it's real ground, you know, but those are sort of bets that your brain is making.
Mm.
Well, when the bet doesn't pay off, when your brain thinks, for instance, that you are taking a painkiller and you're not, turns out you're taking a placebo effect, you've been fooled. Your brain will actually step away and take some steps to make expectation meet reality. It will actually self-medicate. It will actually drop its own drugs in order not to be wrong. And your brain doesn't want to be wrong about that expectation. To a certain extent, it'll go as far as it can go in order to bend reality so that expectation meets reality. And that's what's happening with that. Mm. And it's kind of wild, but when you prime that pump, you're setting up an expectation, and then you're going to find out how far your brain will bend to make that come true.
There was this instance that you talked about getting electric shocked because you're part guinea pig, part researcher. And
putting it nicely.
Yeah. And you definitely took some hits for the team on this one. And maybe you can talk about the time the electric shock situation where your brain was filling in the gaps.
Well, that's that's a great example of what I'm talking about. You know, I went into this laboratory. Luana Coloca is her name. She's a brilliant researcher out of Italy, and she was working at that point with NIH, and she wanted to show me how this worked. So she basically hooked up a bunch of shocking devices up to my hand, and she gave me two shocks. She gave me a high one every time I saw every time I saw a green light, I got a low one. It was sort of a little pinch of a shock. Didn't feel like much. And then every time I saw a red light, I got a high, powerful shock. A shock that was so powerful, my foot actually twitched. Mm. And then they'd go back and forth. And she was actually careful to you'd see the light, and then there'd be a little pause. And you imagine that moment, you're just really, you see the red light, and you're like, oh God, oh God, oh God. Oh. And then wham, you know, you get hit by this thing. And they went back and forth. And then on the third round, it sort of felt like they maybe turned up the lower one a tiny, tiny bit. It was a one, and then it turned into like a sort of a two, but it was, you know, it didn't really change that much. And then the red one was the same. And when she came back in, she said, on that last round, I gave you the big shock every time.
Mm.
And I was not deluding myself. I was not, you know, I wasn't wrong. You know, my foot wasn't twitching. Mm. I didn't have that pain because my brain had stepped in and medicated me against that, because it had set up this prediction. And that moment sort of in between light, you know, seeing the light and the shock, you know, that helps boost that sort of expectation,
mm.
that your brain is really saying, what's happening in the world?
Mm-hmm.
What can I expect? And then it's playing with brain chemistry in order to make that fit.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible. And I think a lot of us have also had the instance where you get like some kind of cut and you don't even realize it. And then when you see it and notice it, all of a sudden it hurts. Or someone's reacting to you, and then you're like, what? What's wrong? And then you have this big gash or something, and you're like, ah, after you notice it. And, you know, you wouldn't have even noticed, and then all of a sudden you realize there's pain. It's just, It's just funny because then your brain's like, this should hurt, shouldn't it?
Well, and this is something that scientists are constantly pulling apart. I mean, what you're describing is distraction. Oh. And that is another part of sort of pain killing, you know, and there's a lot of scientists who've played around with trying to use distraction to kill pain. And is that a part of placebo? Another one, hypnosis seems to affect pain in a similar way. Is that the same rules? Are they different rules doing the same thing? These are all great questions that I think scientists are starting to tease apart. And that example, it may not be a placebo, but it did give birth to a lot of these placebo studies, because there was a scientist in the 1940s who was actually in World War II who would see these soldiers coming. He's a doctor, and he'd see these soldiers come in, and they'd have these, you know, horrible. This one guy had a terrible axe-like wound in his back, and he was and they gave him a shot of morphine. He complained about how much the shot hurt, and he didn't. Like, he was thirsty, but he didn't really notice the thing in his back, and that might have been, it could have been any number of different things, but it really got that science thinking, that doctor thinking about what was going on, and that fed his curiosity for the next 20 years, and really, in some ways, led to the placebo-controlled trial that we have today. And it, you know, whether or not it's the same thing, it definitely gets us thinking about what these things are.
Wow. Well, also, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about memories and false memories. One of the guests I had on my show, one of the guests I had on my show was Dr. Stephen Porter, who his research lab did the really seminal work on false memories and implanting memories. I don't know if you're familiar with his work at all, but what they found was how easy it was to trick people into thinking they had done major crimes as teenagers. And just with like 2 or 3 hour-long sessions with them, they had people convinced that they had done some serious crimes when there was no such thing. And they basically didn't even, they had implanted memories at this point where they had those people. These are ordinary, you know, these are not people with any kind of mental illness or any sort of detriment in their brains. But it makes me wonder about false memories or implanted memories, or even in a beneficial way, that we can, in a sense, create memories that would make us feel healthier. and I don't know how much we want to tweak that exactly, but when you think about every time we retrieve a memory, it's altered. And so all of our memories are actually not exactly accurate. So if we're doing that anyway, it seems like it might make sense to enhance our memory so that we might have healthier lives. And I don't know if that fed into what you've been studying about. I think there's a little piece there that.
Yes, absolutely. I took a very wide definition of suggestibility. I'm very interested in placebo effect. I'm very interested in hypnosis, but I really wanted to broaden this out and talk about, you know, what we see as reality. And you know, I think of placebos as sort of being a suggestion for the future. You know, this will make you feel better. And I think of hypnosis as being a suggestion for the present. This will, you know, you're walking through a field of flowers and your pain, like, you know, evaporates like water off your shoulders or whatever. That's all in the present. And then false memories, regardless of the mechanism, it's thematically sort of it's a suggestion of the past. This thing that you think happened didn't actually happen. Or this thing you did, and they fit together. And a lot of placebo scientists and the group people in this world have sort of flirted with this idea. So I just jumped right into it. And I have to say, you know, placebos are really fun. Hypnosis is really fun. And I really enjoyed all that stuff. False memories are scary. These things. I gotta say, this was the most disturbing part of my research. Who we are is so much tied up in our memories, and when those you can't trust those memories, things get a little funny. And to say nothing of, as you alluded to, some of the legal ramifications that come from not being able to trust your memory. On the whole, I found false memories to be very disturbing. And in the book, if you read the book, I talked to a young woman who was given a false memory at 10 and sort of had it taken away in her 20s. And it was a pretty disturbing memory. And sort of trying to cope with that has been very difficult for her. But there are some interesting ways to think of it in terms of health. Mm-hmm. There are a few folks who, as you said, a memory is basically, it has three phases. They have the moment when you see the thing, the moment when you, sort of catalog that thing into your long-term memory, and the moment where you pull it back up again and remember it again. Mm-hmm. And in each one of those processes, something can go wrong. And there have been some scientists looking at, PTSD, mm-hmm. who have wondered if maybe some of these errors can be used to help people who are struggling with horrible things they've seen. And the relationship between memory and sleep especially has been, I think, a very interesting area of study. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, there may be something good to come out of it. I also feel personally, having grown up in the religion that I did, that memories play a big role in our expectation for healing. And when people talk about, let's say, be it, homeopathy or some miracle pill that they got online, and they tried it, and immediately the pain disappeared, and immediately like they felt better, and the world became a better place. Well, in my experience, rarely is it immediate, but in our memory, it always is. Memories tend to lean more towards a narrative that makes sense, and when you remember something immediately, profoundly changing. Well, that once again primes you for the future, primes you for future healing, and so it sort of feeds into all of these questions in a way that, that work hasn't been done on that. I'd like to see someone study that, but that's been my experience. A lot of the rest of false memories, it's just disturbing.
Yeah, it's really dicey. They had to pull the plug on the study because it ran into too many questionable things because it was just too easy to do. And then you're messing with real people, and it's just too easy. But actually hearing that story, for me, having just different disturbing memories, I actually found a great relief in that. I thought, it's possible that, every time you're retrieving a memory, it's altering it just a bit. It's possible that the stuff I might be getting wound up about, it's possible 30% wrong, or maybe 15% wrong. And if that's possible, I shouldn't put too much weight in my recall, because it is changing each time I think of it. And so maybe I'm putting too much weight on something. And so I actually found it to be sort of freeing for me, so that anything I was putting, because the negative ones are going to last, longer and have more of an impression and maybe affect my well-being or my health or something. So I thought, maybe I should just hold that with a looser grasp. And
that's a really good idea. I like that. And I have not heard that before.
And I just for me thinking, I don't have this one locked up. It's better for me to think that memories are more fluid than I think they are.
There's been a lot of those powerful memories. People call them flashbulb memories. They're memories like there's a great study that I think it was, God, I forget if it was the Challenger or the 9/11. I think it was the Challenger explosion. Mm-hmm. And there's a scientist who basically took a survey of all of his students, freshman students, and saw, that they wrote down where they were and what they were doing when they got the news. Mm-hmm. And he asked them again, 3 or 4 years later, when they were about to graduate, to tell where they were. And many of them had changed their story to be much more dramatic and much more impactful than they had actually been. And when he showed them the original descriptions, not only did they not believe it, but they thought he had changed it, or he had done something. They were much more tied to their memories than they were, willing to believe their handwriting and remember what really happened. And that's a powerful lesson to take away.
Wow.
We don't want to let those go. We really don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't want to just chalk them up to completely fabricated. But it is interesting how much they shape us then.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was also curious to see what you found in terms of Eastern medicine versus Western medicine. Is the viewpoint different about placebo?
Yeah, that was a, you know, I spent some time in China talking to Eastern practitioners. I really didn't have much expectation about what I'd find. You know, it's tricky. And first of all, I mean, what I found was that everyone does this. You know, mm-hmm. we all have, you know, the, I think we, it's very easy to say, well, you know, the Chinese medicine is this and that. Well, mm-hmm. you know, before you do that, you know, look in your own backyard. Look what, you know, look at the ways that you mm-hmm. sort of play with your expectation. You know, is that vitamin you're taking really affecting you, you know? So that, okay, so let, you know, we're all guilty. All right, mm-hmm. we'll leave that. I think that there is a new reality that you know, Chinese medicine was very much, has very much been impacted by sort of the China's development since Mao Zedong. And it's constantly changing, but a lot of the Chinese medicine, so Chinese medicine, basically that one of the problems with it is that there's no way to actually prove that something, take mercury. Mm-hmm. It's a part of Chinese medicine, but there's no way, and we all know it's very dangerous mm-hmm. to ingest mercury, but there's no way to actually exclude it from Chinese medicine. Mm-hmm. It's not used very commonly now. Everyone knows that it's not the best ingredient, but it's not truly excluded because there's not really an experimental paradigm to say, okay, well, artemisinin, which is, you know, taken from these, from this bark, and is really good at fighting malaria. Well, that's in, and mercury is out, and that's something that I had a lot of trouble. So that this is the scientific method that we use, and as a result, and instead, Chinese medicine revolves around a singular truth, is the way it was described to me. Whereas Western medicine moves forward in a line, Chinese medicine revolves around a singular truth, which, to my ears, sounds a lot like religion. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just my bias, having grown up in a healing religion. And in that case, you can never get away from placebos. You know, if you don't have a comparison, mm-hmm. you can never escape it. So you never really know mm-hmm. which elements are placebo and which ones aren't. Mm-hmm. And that's so many of the therapies in Chinese medicine are placebo, and I think that's been shown again and again. But I think that the Chinese people are sort of slowly adapting to this, and they're putting Chinese medicine in a certain category of conditions that you have, you know, and these are conditions that I think often track with placebo research. And you talk about pain, mm-hmm. talk about depression, irritable bowel syndrome, anxiety, and in Western medicine we talk a lot about Parkinson's. I didn't come across Parkinson's in China, but those other ones, that's the world of Chinese medicine to many of the people I spoke with. This is, you know, and if you break your arm or if you have cancer, you go to a Western doctor. But for some of these other conditions, their placebo and belief play a much bigger role, and you can harness these things. But you have to be careful if you have cancer or if you have a disease that does not respond. A great one is Alzheimer's, does not respond well to belief or placebo. Obsessive-compulsive disorder doesn't seem to respond very well to placebo. And if you have something that doesn't respond to placebo, you know, you're not going to get the same results as if you have chronic pain or irritable bowel, like bowel problems. Those things do. And I think the people I spoke to in China, they're sort of organically moving that direction, where certain things are appropriate for Chinese medicine, certain things aren't. Mm. And I think that's true throughout the world. You know, you talk to shamans across the world, and, you know, going back decades, you know, people who've investigated these things, that good shamans know the limits of what they're doing. And it's an important thing to keep in mind. It's a very important thing to take away from my book.
Yeah. And in terms of what you think, like, with all your research, did it affect how you deal with certain things, deal with pain or things with your own health?
Yeah, I'm currently sort of fighting off a little bit of a cold, and I basically throwing everything I possibly can at it, and from sensory input to, you know, mental states, everything I can. I think it's a very, if you read my book, you won't lose any of your placebo. You won't lose any of your ability to have placebos. There's nothing in there that that will ruin it for you. I think if anything, it'll strengthen it and give you some perspective. I would say, though, if you write my book, you may have some problems down the line. I'm having some, you know, it is, I don't trust anything anymore. I don't even trust my own brain anymore. So I do think you have to be careful when you write a book like this.
You pulled back the curtain too far.
Maybe too far.
Well, it's funny because you have to have a critical eye to research, and then you wind up maybe thinking so much that you are an objective observer so much that you kind of can't get in the moment. I mean, I can feel for you there too, because I try to encounter things like with curiosity and objectivity as best I can.
You also have to remember that, you know, we talk about placebo and belief in these different things, you know, and you know, Chinese medicine, but these things are not exclusively in the world of alternative medicine and, mm-hmm. and sugar pills. They're also on top of active medicine. So when you take an active medicine, there's a placebo effect and on top of that. There's the expectation on top of that. Mm. So when you start thinking about those questions, and something the pharmaceutical industry constantly has to deal with, when you think about those questions, then you start to sometimes lose faith in anything you think you know, because it's a part of everything you do. Think about when you take a pill and you got a headache and you're just really hammering away, and you just want some relief. And you go and you find your pill and you put it in your mouth and you drink that water. And, oh, thank God. You know, oh, okay. You know, I don't know if this ever happened to you like that. That's the way it happens to me. And but that pill doesn't kick in for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So what are you feeling there?
I know, dehydration got quenched or something. Yeah, I know. I've definitely felt like relief that way too. And you're wondering, what the heck was that?
That's a placebo response. Yeah. That's a very classic placebo response. And, you know, and that's on top of the medicine that's clearly active. So, you know, this is not something that's limited to sugar pills. This is a part of everything we do.
Mm-hmm. And I think you were mentioning too, or maybe I've heard this in other places as well, it's like the color of the pill. Like, they never make sleeping pills red, they make them blue, and there's certain different shapes and things like that that go into the entire process of making medicines.
Well, you know, and I just got off the phone with a guy who works with athletes, and he was saying that, you know, he's stopped giving them like green and blue. He works with placebos and stuff. He's giving them green and blue pills because it doesn't really seem to affect them as much, and they refuse to take black pills. but he has this red and white striped pill that he gives them, and they love it. You know, it's really, really big, 2-centimeter long thing. And they all say, oh, that's gotta be the real thing. And yeah, this is very much true. You know, the cheapest way to make a pill is obviously, you know, with no color. So why do companies put so many colors on these pills? Well, it's not just marketing. I mean, marketing is another way to harness placebo effects. And so, some studies have suggested that in France, suppositories work better than pills, and in Britain, bitter flavors work better than sweet ones, and injections work better than pills, and fake surgeries work better than fake injections. You know, there's a lot of subtlety to this that we're still wrapping our heads around.
When I was hearing like what works best with placebo, you were saying chronic pain, irritable bowel, anxiety, obsessive compulsive, and Parkinson's was the surprise to me, but I don't know that much about Parkinson's, but why would you think that would have some sort of effect? Like, what about the structure of the brain or the disease?
So first of all, obsessive compulsive, to my understanding, as of yet, it does not.
Oh,
it's actually low.
Oh,
so when
okay.
you compare, you know, anxiety versus, you know, you have, there seem that what's going on with these is the takeaway is that there seem to be rules at play.
Hmm.
You know, if you get a 60%, you know, response from some sort of pain drug, and then you get, you know, you get some Alzheimer's and it's much, much lower, 10% or something. You know, something's going on there.
Mm.
And we're just sort of, you know, that's what's really exciting about this is mm-hmm. that this is not just some psychological mumbo jumbo in our head. Like, there are rules. Something's going on.
Hmm.
And there are rules, then we can learn them. And Parkinson's is a great example. Hmm. Parkinson's has an extremely high placebo response.
Hmm.
And why is that? Well, because Parkinson's is it's a chronic deficiency of something called dopamine, which it's a chemical in our brain that is involved with many different things. It's one of these chemicals that seems to have a lot of different jobs. It holds down a lot of work at once. You know, it's one of these hardworking drugs that we have in our head. But one of those is in the reward processing part of our brain, how we process expectation and reward. And what is a placebo if not reward? And dopamine seems to have its fingers in a lot of placebo pots. It seems to be doing a lot. Now, is you know, I talked about endogenous opioids, these things, these painkillers inside of us. Now, you know, if you have a pain placebo, you know, is the opioid more important than the dopamine? Well, we don't know those questions exactly yet, and we're still figuring that out. But it definitely has a big role to play, and if you look at something like Parkinson's, well, it's completely centered around dopamine. So it's not surprising that you have these people getting better, because what you're doing is you're playing with the central player in this performance. You know, that this key actor, and that seems to be the rule of why Parkinson's has such a high placebo rate. It makes it very hard to treat. It makes it very hard to come up with to study, because, you know, you just have these. How do you figure out if something's working if 60 or 70% of your patients are getting better on placebos? Like, how do you possibly work with that?
That's right. It's going to throw everything off. Yeah,
absolutely.
Wow, and can you explain what nocebo is too?
Sure. So, the root of placebo is I shall please, and the root of nocebo is I shall harm. It's a simple matter of if I say, oh, this thing will make you feel better. Well, a nocebo is this thing is going to make you feel worse. It's very hard to study, as you can imagine. You're certainly allowed to go to a Parkinson's patient and tell them that this pill will make them feel better. But you can't go to a Parkinson's patient and say this will make your Parkinson's worse. That's just not ethical. You can't do it. And so nocebos are actually very hard to study. The easiest way to do it is with pain. And I did a few of these sort of experiments, and if I tell you this will hurt more, then you can sort of study that, and we've come to some understanding of some of the chemicals that are involved in pain nocebos. And one of the things that we've learned as of now, this is, again, it's very hard to study, is that nocebos do seem to be more powerful, or certainly more easy to initiate than a placebo. If you can imagine someone saying, like, you know, this thing I'm going to do to your back will make your back feel really good, you know, and it's like, well, I'll believe it when I see it, you know, and you kind of have to be like practice or have something, you know, done many times before you sort of start to believe it. But if someone says, this is really going to hurt, you ready? This is going to really hurt. You don't need any practice. You start getting nervous right away. And that's the power. I mean, you know, it's fear.
Yeah.
It's fear. And fear is a powerful motivator in our bodies.
Yeah, we're definitely bracing for that sort of thing. And this might be a good time to talk about a witch doctor situation. I guess that plays into, like, especially in areas where there's a lot of, there's maybe witch doctors or things like curses and things like that, where somebody can, manipulate someone else by saying, you know, I'm going to do this thing to make you sick, or, you know, some kind of potion or something like that. It seems like that would be a lot easier to manipulate people toward the negative than even towards the positive.
Yeah. I mean, that again, in my book, I think I try to make it clear that, you know, I do wander into superstition and curses, but I'm wandering pretty far afield, and there's not a lot to work with. I'll be honest with you. This is some open territory that I'm wandering into. So if there's any scientists I talk to, hopefully they're understanding of that. And this is very hard, but superstition, you know, there's no question that there is an overlap with superstition and fear and bodily harm, which is a nocebo. And so, I was speaking to a sports scientist, and he was talking about the nocebo of sports and how certain players can walk around and sort of like, ooh, those shoes don't look real good. Like, you know, you're really going to, you know, like the way you can kind of cause a player to maybe play 10%, you know, less well, or just get that edge. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true in our lives. You know, fear plays a big role in our lives. And so when someone, a lot of witch doctors I talked to told me, well, you need to tell someone they're cursed before the curse can work. And right there, you know, you're already kind of eating away at the supernatural power of the curse if you have to tell someone. And so I thought I'd give it a shot. And so I actually hired a guy to curse me for a week, and just to see what would happen, what I do to myself. And you have to read the book. It's a fascinating mm-hmm. story of what happens to me that week. But I will say that it doesn't when something goes wrong, it doesn't take very long for a reasoned man of science mm-hmm. to very quickly switch over and become a very superstitious person. Mm-hmm. You know, these things are not, you know, it's not, you know, we don't acknowledge the fear in our lives, but it's right there below the surface. Mm-hmm. And if you open yourself up to it, it comes in pretty quickly. So I do end up causing myself some undue panic.
Yeah, we'll leave a cliffhanger so people have a good reason to pick up your book. But I think that's really fascinating how we can feel we're very reasonable, everything's great, I'm, you know, rational person, scientific person, but when things hit the fan, you can look around for, you know, the causation correlation stuff, and you can really get weirded out pretty
Lisa?
Quick.
Mm-hmm. Are you a person of science? Do you consider yourself to be a very rational person?
Probably not. I'd like to say I'm moving in that direction.
Would you get yourself cursed? Would you?
You know,
would that be something?
That's a really good question, because I think you're braver than I am. I think, Eric.
Well, it was. I can't tell you how many people rational, intelligent people who I talked to who said that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Why would you do that? You know,
like why would you do that? Because it's dangerous, or why would you do that? Because they don't believe in it.
No, because it's dangerous. Ah. Like, you know, and I asked, you know, I had a good friend who, you know, he's been a war correspondent for many years, very, mm-hmm. very, you know, brave mm-hmm. Reporter. And he said, Dad, you were just an idiot. And I, mm-hmm. you know, and I said, well, you know, do you believe in curses? And he said, well, no, but, but I still wouldn't do that. You know, and I think that sums up most people's perspective.
Yeah, like,
no.
But yeah, well, it's crazy, but no way.
No.
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny because we can admit that we don't know everything, and that sounds like the silliest thing ever, but then, yeah, but I don't know everything. Maybe there's something, you know, everybody's afraid of it. Maybe it's because there's something, but I have to, you know, I have to think that, there's so much phony about it that it seems so obvious on the surface. It seems so, so phony, but at the same time, you know that if anything bad happens, that's the first thing that's going to pop up in your mind. And that alone kind of drives you crazy. So I could see that you're putting yourself in quite a spot.
It is. It's a fascinating spot. And there's a logical fallacy called proper hoc, ergo hoc, which sort of, mm-hmm. you know, it sort of, you do go back and you look for the cause of anything so that things make sense. And the problem with this is not that we're, that these people are crazy or that it's stupid. Like, this is who we are. Mm-hmm. This is not about, you know, who's more gullible. This is a matter of this is who we are, mm-hmm. and our bodies respond to this. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is are there certain people whose bodies respond more? Mm. And that's something we're just gonna have to wait to hear.
And I think you're right. The part about the predictive part of the brain is plays into this so much, because if you're predictive and you're gonna look for anything that might have been helpful to predict, even if it's sounds and is irrational.
We're creating narratives. Mm. All of this book, this is all about the narratives that we tell ourselves. Mm. You know, we're telling ourselves stories, and the doctor's telling you a story when he tells you what he's doing, and the witch doctor's telling you a story. All of these things are stories that we tell, and that's how we make sense of the world, and that's what your brain's trying to do. It's doing prediction and expectation in order to make sense of the world in a story. And that's what you're playing with when you start playing with these things, is the story that we're telling ourselves. Mm.
Well, see, you did a curse on yourself, which is very brave, but would you ever do a curse on someone else?
Oh, no, I don't think that's a good thing to do, because you don't know how that person's going to respond. And if, you know, I believe it is possible to, in certain circumstances, cause serious disease and death mm-hmm. from fear from mm-hmm. curses, and you don't know if the person you're cursing is going to. I mean, in order to do it properly, you'd have to tell them,
right?
Right. You just don't know
right.
how they're going to respond, and that
right, right.
It's all fun and games on yourself. But I couldn't find any direct examples, mm-hmm. Verifiable examples of people who died from fear and belief exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that I would offer for someone else to do.
Yeah. If they didn't know, if you think it's a hoax and they didn't know, would you try it?
No, because why would you do that? Why would you use someone else as your guinea pig? Yeah, that's not very nice. But why would you, if you have a drug that you think probably doesn't work, mm-hmm. but you're not sure, you wouldn't put it in someone else's drink without telling them, right? Like, that seems to be, you know, you have someone sneaking into yours when you're not expecting it. Like, you know, I would probably pass it up and say, look, someone needs to curse me between now and 2018, and I don't tell me when. And that seems a lot more fair, right? I think that's the right way to do it.
Well, I appreciate that you're that ethical and that you would just curse yourself. But
I'm a little disturbed that you'd be cursing your friends. No.
I have all these dolls with pins in them right now. No, I was just curious if you think that it's not, if curses are phony, then it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter if you did it. But see, I actually think what I think is more true is that our intentions can somehow affect other people, and not in a less spooky way than people think, but just because we exude things through body language and all kinds of other ways that can actually be harmful. I actually think it would be, unethical for different sorts of reasons, but.
Body language is very important. And I think that's something that we often overlook. You know, this is something that doctors need to really be very aware of is their body language and the messages we're conveying. My first work was actually with dolphin intelligence research. And a lot of dolphin intelligence researchers will have to wear sunglasses. In order to do an experiment, because a dolphin can infer from your body, from your eye movements, what the correct answer might be. Mm. And so you can bias the study by letting the dolphin see your eyes. Now that's a dolphin. Imagine the subtle cues that we give each other. Mm-hmm. You know, this is an animal in different species. You know, we are equally social creatures. You know, the number of signals we're taking from each other every day is countless. So mm-hmm. these are really important elements to health, and doctors need to keep that in mind because they're constantly having a conversation below the surface mm-hmm. with their patients.
Yeah, it's like all the stuff I've read is like could be up to 90% can be communicated nonverbally, and it's an incredible amount. Sometimes we're just trying to get our story straight or our message out as best as we can, but it's actually we're conveying so much more with all those subtle cues and forgetting that that's actually the bulk of the communication that's happening. And that's why with doctors who are maybe not so sure that a medicine's going to make any difference are going to convey all those insecurities over to their patients. And
yep.
Yeah,
doctors sometimes can be too smart for their own good. You know, they may be thinking of all the different things that could go wrong, or the other, things they might be doing afterwards or later, and those insecurities get passed on to the patient. I talked to numerous scientists who had to learn how to convey placebo responses to their subjects, because it's not. Some people do it very easily. Other people, they have to learn how to do it. And I think it would be a great thing for doctors to think about. Are you conveying a placebo or not?
And I guess for parents, too, with their kids trying to – I can think of just being a parent of two kids. They're older now. But, you know, I remember growing up and everything could be cured with an ice pack pretty much. You know? And there's a lot to be said for you know, not if your child has something that's not really that wrong. If you don't freak out, the kid doesn't freak out. And there's a lot of instances where I think we can convey certain things, not in a way to deceive people, but in a way to help them be more calm or to be projecting the best thing for everybody in the situation, or the healthiest thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So where can people get your book and find out what you're up to and all of your work?
The easiest place to go is suggestibleyou.com. It's got all of the events I've got coming up. It's got buttons to, you know, how to get the book, you know, Amazon and all, and local booksellers and all that kind of thing. So suggestibleyou.com is probably the place to go. And then, of course, ericvance.com has some of my other work from other realms of my existence. But mm-hmm. Suggestible You is probably the way to go. Also, you can just reach out to me on Twitter. I'm at Eric Vance. That's E-R-I-K, V as in Victor, A-N-C-E. And that's another way to reach me.
That's great. And then you'll be touring around some places soon, and mm-hmm. people could run into you and get you to sign their book.
Absolutely.
What are some of the places? Where will you be?
I'll be in California for another week or so. I think Sebastopol, and then I'll be going up to Seattle, and then taking a break for Thanksgiving, and going up to Washington D.C., Boston. I'll be out in Tulsa, and then coming back to California and New York after that in the new year.
That's great. Well, I wish you the best, Eric. This has been really fun, and I appreciate what you've been doing. Your work has been really fascinating.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I appreciate you having me.
Don't forget to check out sparkmymuse.com, where there's show notes to this episode and every episode, with related links and photos and all kinds of extra goodies.